Hello, I'm Aaron Rand of the Urbanophile, www.urbanophile.com, and I'm joined here today by Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley. Mayor Cranley, thank you for taking the time.
It's great to be here.
Want to first tell you a little bit about Cincinnati for those of you who don't know it. It's a really amazing city that I always say likes to have the single best collection of civic assets of any city its size in America. It's in a beautiful river valley setting, a great geography of hills and trees. It's got fantastic historic architecture and neighborhoods like Over the Rhine, which I happen to think actually has better bones than Brooklyn in a lot of ways. A lot of contemporary architecture as well. Many large and important corporations like Procter & Gamble and Kroger. Fantastic cultural institutions like the Cincinnati Symphony and Pops Orchestra, which, believe it or not, has sold over 10 million albums. Great neighborhoods. All sorts of quirky, unique little cultural items of a type you don't see in other cities that much these days, like Cincinnati-style chili. The city of Cincinnati itself has a population of around 300,000 people, with a metro area of about 2.1 million. It's 28th largest in America. Mayor Cranley is a Democrat. He was just elected this fall, so it was relatively early in his administration, but he's not new to local politics. He was on the city council for many years. He's also a Harvard Law grad who co-founded the Ohio Innocence Project and ran that organization for some years. That's a group dedicated to exonerating those wrongfully convicted of crimes. He's a Cincinnati native who I grew up, I believe, in the West Side neighborhood of Price Hill. Once again, thank you for being here, Mayor Cranley.
It's interesting that you note the Brooklyn connection to Over the Rhine. Mm-hmm. You know, the Suspension Bridge, which is a gorgeous, you know, real anchor for a river, is the model for the Brooklyn Bridge, the actual
right.
Brooklyn Bridge, which is not surprising because the Italianate architecture in Over the Rhine was built in the late 19th century,
mm-hmm.
not too long after both the Suspension Bridge and the Brooklyn Bridge went mm-hmm. under construction post-Civil War. So I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't thought about the architecture of Brooklyn and Over the Rhine, but I think that's a good point.
You know, when I first visited Over the Rhine, some of these neighborhoods in Cincinnati in the early 90s, my first thing is, this is like Brooklyn. I mean, it's like, it's different type of architecture even than you see in a lot of other kind of northern Midwest cities, because Cincinnati was huge in like the 1830s.
Yes.
It was out of control, even how big the city was when Chicago was a trading post.
Right, exactly.
So I just rattle off some of the things that Cincinnati has. It's a lot, but what are you most proud of about the city?
Well, I mean, I agree with your analysis that we have, for a city our size, we have more assets than any city in America. We have more Fortune 500 companies per capita. We have an incredibly deep economy. You know, while we have a huge manufacturing base, when manufacturing was lost and was the lifeblood of Pittsburgh and Cleveland and Akron and Toledo, et cetera, we were service before service was cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were a P&G city since 19th century. So we've been able to weather a lot of the changing economics for cities a lot better than others. And we have, I think, I like to say, if you're pursuing your dreams, you know, if you're a starving artist, you go to New York.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a young entrepreneur who wants to get into consumer marketing, we are literally the consumer marketing capital of the world. P&G and Macy's and Kroger spend more combined on advertising than any, mm-hmm. probably any equivalent city. We have over, I believe it's 20,000 employees, not P&G Macy's, but in the consumer marketing field. So we have a very vibrant culture of entrepreneurialism. We have, of course, this great history and pride. And we're poised at the moment to capture the new urbanism that is flooding the country, in the sense that there is a great deal of new demand for mm-hmm. urban living by young professionals, empty nesters. And I think we are better positioned to turbocharge and capitalize on that
mm-hmm.
momentum than any city of anywhere near our size and scope. And candidly, it's already happening. I mean, we've essentially doubled our downtown population in 10 years. We will double our downtown population again, I believe, in the next 5 years. We will double our population Over the Rhine again in the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to, I can get into the specifics, but from our river, our riverfront park will be, frankly, more user-friendly and larger than Millennium Park in Chicago. As you head north, we have a revitalized riverfront area, Fountain Square, over the Rhine, and we're going up the hill to Clifton into the UC, into a research and medical corridor up there. We have 80,000 jobs downtown, 60,000 jobs uptown. Many downtowns would encompass both our downtown and our Clifton area, meaning geographically they'd be flat and they would have both. It would all be considered one large downtown. Like Columbus is spread out that way. Other cities are spread out. Indianapolis.
Yeah, Indianapolis, so their downtown is 5.5 square miles. In Indianapolis, they would say over the Rhine is downtown.
Correct.
Here, you would think that's a separate neighborhood.
Correct. So if you look at it of connecting uptown and downtown, 140,000 jobs, and what most people would consider one large downtown. For a city our size, nobody can hold a candle to that kind of jobs. And these aren't just any jobs. These are extremely well-paying, deep corporate roots, which then results to huge corporate philanthropy in the arts, into revitalization. I mean, our revitalization is happening in large part because P&G and Macy's and Kroger's decided to invest in an organization called 3CDC 10 years ago, which I'm proud to say that I was instrumental in helping to get started as a councilman at the time. And we made a concerted effort to re-urbanize and repopulate our urban core, and we're bearing the fruit of that today. And we're going to turbocharge those efforts.
Now, I was an undergrad business major at Indiana University when I went to school. And coming out of that, it's a pretty big undergrad business school.
Right.
There were two companies that everybody seemed to want to work for. Either you wanted to be a brand manager at P&G, or you wanted to go work for Anderson Consulting, which is now called Accenture. And I went to work for Anderson Consulting. But Cincinnati and going to work for P&G was huge in terms of like aspirational employment for people coming out of there.
Right.
In fact, I had friends that did that. No historic connection to Cincinnati, but the P&G, they wanted to get in. I mentioned that unlike a lot of places that have kind of been genericized, Cincinnati has really held on to a lot of local cultural uniqueness and feel. How has it managed to do that?
Well, I think it's, I mean, first of all, we have these traditions of people who candidly stay, which is great. And we have sort of these brands that have some real staying power. So you have, you know, in the ice cream, you got Grater's, which is famous. You got, you know, Montgomery Inn Ribs, which, you know, Bob Hope used to order from around the world from Cincinnati. Chili, you mentioned. Now, candidly, I have my biases because my wife's family owns Gold Star Chili, which is one of the two big dominating companies. Skyline has larger market share, but Gold Star's coming on. And both are doing very, very well and are very unique to Cincinnati in terms of their taste and approach. You know, what am I forgetting in terms of the food?
La Rosa's
pizza is insane.
The biggest market share of any pizza company.
Yeah, local, which is a West Side guy. In fact, I lived next to the founder for years. Is there. Then you've got the oldest baseball team in the United States in professional baseball. So we have this history of being a major league city, both the Bengals and the Reds, but predominantly the Reds, for as longer than any city in the United States. And the big red machine, the tradition, is just so deep. And then you've got the natural beauty and the hills, the architecture that you already mentioned, the bones of the city. I mean, what modern new urbanist cities try to emulate, candidly, is what we were in the 19th century and are again today and increasingly, is taking advantage of pedestrian-friendly, mixed-use, incredible architectural assets and repopulating those assets in a way that's incredibly dense for a city our size. Now, and then part of that is that, as you point out, over the Rhine is considered a different neighborhood than downtown. We maintained 52 neighborhoods with real, to this day, sense of culture and community that is unique and creates within, I think, the culture and the citizens living in these neighborhoods a real sense of pride, both for Cincinnati but also for their particular neighborhood. You know, so Price Hill has a long history of, you know, sort of Catholic, German, Irish, mm-hmm. you know, West Side, you know, family friendly. You know, Westwood had the home, sadly, against my wishes, previous administration tore down the historic building where the Procter & Gamble mm-hmm. soap rose to the top of the tub. Was sort of, the, mm-hmm. in many ways, the most significant thing that ever happened to Cincinnati was the creation of Procter & Gamble. Mm-hmm. And Westwood was the home of, you know, now most of the moneyed people live on the east side, but at right. the time it was more disputed, mm-hmm. West and east. And the founder of the Ivory Soap lived in Westwood. Whether you've got Clifton, which of course is our, you know, sort of, mm-hmm. well, until Over the Rhine has really taken off, more of our sort of eclectic bohemian, you know, mm-hmm. student university research. And then that blends into Northside, which has traditionally been the gay neighborhood, but it's now, mm-hmm. you know, even getting more diverse than that, and it's been, you know, fantastic, and it has an identity to, you know, the history of Mount Auburn, mm-hmm. where you got William Howard Taft House, and you've got, you know, where Christ Hospital is. You look mm-hmm. down on the city, Mount Adams, which of course,
it's like a Midwestern San Francisco.
Exactly,
right up there. It's exactly what.
Well,
it's
as called. I always say, if Chicago is the New York of the Midwest, we're the San Francisco of the Midwest. In fact, that's exactly my line. It's mm-hmm. to say, Chicago is the New York of the Midwest. We're the San Francisco because we have the hills, the architecture, the arts. Culture, the big league teams, all the advantages of a major city with the livability of a small town, and everyone has an opportunity to be a big fish, you know, if you've got that kind of ambition. And it really is, again, we've proven that's true because we've been able to maintain such a concentration of Fortune 500 companies, which then, of course, leads to all kinds of spin-off businesses, a huge privately held company, group of businesses that have really been family traditions that have lasted mm-hmm. 100 years and have really continued to come. As I like to point out, what city our size has an entire company dedicated to Shakespeare? It was Shakespeare Theater mm-hmm. that does all Shakespeare, and it has a full-blown season. That's in addition to our, you know, our Broadway play show, the mm-hmm. Aronoff, which is the big, mm-hmm. you know, the big place, plus several smaller theaters, including the Ensemble, Playhouse in the Park, which is the, you know, another professional troupe. You've got the No Theater, which is real edgy stuff, and Over the Rhine. You've got, none of this, by the way, is Music Hall, which is one of the greatest treasures anywhere in the country in terms of its beauty, its accessibility, its long-term use. I was just reading this great book by Doris Kearns Goodwin, Bully Pulpit, mm-hmm. about how William Howard Taft's wife actually founded the symphony. It's got the May Festival, the symphony, you know, the ballet is at the Aronoff. But the amount of arts and culture is just unprecedented for a city our size and enduring.
One difference from San Francisco is extremely politically left.
Yeah.
And Cincinnati has a long history of social conservatism. How does that play out in the modern era here?
Well, I think that has, I mean, I think that's changed. It's different, I guess. But, you know, I'm proud to say that, you know, I mean, you take one rather prominent issue of gay rights. You know, in 1993, an anti-gay law was passed in the city charter, which was awful and was a stain on our reputation for 10 years. When I was on council, we had a transvestite who was murdered, and even the very conservative police chief of police said that this was a hate crime, and I led the effort to ban or add sexual orientation to our hate crime law, and that was sort of, this was in 2002, I believe, 2002 or 3, it might have been mm-hmm. 2003, and this had only been 10 years mm-hmm. since the charter thing had been passed. Mm-hmm. Remember, the charter thing was passed in the aftermath of Bill Clinton being elected and gays in the military, mm-hmm. that first debate. And several cities, including Denver, mm-hmm. Colorado, passed virtually identical, mm-hmm. which had been run by a right-wing group around the country, and they went on several states. And what was passed here was also passed in Colorado,
mm-hmm.
very progressive, I mean, that we all believe is a fairly urban.
Less progressive at the time. Yeah.
Well, the same with Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. Okay, but the difference was that the Colorado charter language for their state was struck down by the federal courts in that district, and we sued to get it undone. And so the city council was virtually unanimously opposed. Maybe one or two folks were for it. And so
there's just this initiative process here, right, that people can amend the charter kind of
right,
without,
yeah,
without
right.
the political...
But it passed, but it passed in the frenzy of the post-Clinton first reaction. My point is simply that, yes, the voters voted the wrong way, but so did they did also in Colorado. The difference was that in both cases, the elected officials were more progressive-oriented and against this charter amendment. Both the state of Colorado and the city of Cincinnati sued to have this undone as unconstitutional. Colorado, it was struck down by the federal courts. In Cincinnati, the conservative judges that were appointed in the Sixth Circuit upheld it. So we were stuck with it when Colorado got the benefit of having it taken out by federal courts. Okay, that was a huge problem for us. So then in 2003, I led the effort to expand our hate crimes law to include sexual orientation. And then a year later, our entire community came together to repeal the charter language with an actual vote of the people. Remember, Colorado, which I love Colorado, I love Denver, it's an awesome city. They never actually convinced their population to undo that law. It was undone by judges. Here, we went on a major effort, and we progressively, in 2004, in the midst of Bush getting reelected to Hamilton County, 54-46, got the thing repealed by a substantial margin, which showed a real shift in our culture and our attitudes. And then we immediately passed, reinstated the human rights ordinance. We immediately reinstated the non-discrimination. We passed benefits for domestic partners and many, many other things. So candidly, and this is why I think it's so important that you're here, is we need to get the message out that we're one of the few cities that actually 10 years ago, now you're seeing legislatures around the country pass gay marriage laws and things of that nature. But still, that's still brief. Mostly it's being done by the judiciary. We're one of the few communities in the country that voted affirmatively to reject within 10 years what was done in haste at a time, and obviously things have changed. But we were that was 10 years ago that we repealed that ordinance. So that charter issue. So I believe that it is true that we have a history of very active conservative folks who pushed the original 93 charter language. But that was part of a national effort that included Colorado and others. And I believe that we have moved many, many miles since then. In addition, let's not fail to point out that we've been incredibly progressive as it comes to civil rights and to police community relations. We had, in 2001, a very difficult time with police and community, and the black community in particular. And we voted to invite the Justice Department into Cincinnati to mediate rather than litigate allegations of police misconduct. And we led to the 2002 collaborative agreement, which I'm proud to say I helped negotiate, which is now held up as a role model for how to improve police community relations around the country. In fact, the judge in New York who struck down the stop and frisk law in New York City specifically cited Cincinnati's collaborative agreement as the right way for the police and the community to work together. In fact, last week, the Department of Justice, Ron Davis, who's the head of the COPS program, Community-Oriented Policing, this is the Bill Clinton program, to put 100,000 cops in the street, and they come on with symposiums and they tackle issues like this. Well, de Blasio made a big issue about stop and frisk and getting rid of it, and brought in Bratton to say we've got to help heal the divide between the New York Police Department and the black community. And they invited me to go and to serve as an example of how Cincinnati has grappled with these issues when other cities have ignored them. Just last year in Cleveland, there was a very unfortunate shooting that has caused a lot of issues there. 15 years ago, when we had our problems, the African-American ministers were leading the protest on City Hall. Now, African-American ministers are leading night prayer vigils and walks within the community to reduce the violence. That's how far we've come, is that there's been a genuine improvement in civil rights in a sense that basic constitutional rights are protected, number one. But secondly, when there are issues, because people are human, that there's a fair process in which those will be investigated and fully vetted.
Mm-hmm.
And a community collaborative approach to combating crime. And so I respectfully say that I understand that we have some baggage in terms of what happened in 1993 on gay rights. And we've had, you know, in the 80s and 70s,
Mapplethorpe.
So I'm not denying that there isn't some reason for that reputation, but I don't think it's no longer fair.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't been fair for at least 10 years since we repealed, or actually I would say since the collaborative in 2002, mm-hmm. and in 2004, collaborative was dealing with civil rights issues, and then in 2004 when we repealed the, or our own people voted to undo the damage that had been done on the anti-gay rights charters and stuff.
One of the items from your campaign manifesto was around race relations and healing race relations here, because you did mention that in 2001 there were some disturbances in the Over the Rhine area.
Yeah.
And then, which I know there had been some tensions, is there's kind of this gentrification with the historic black community. And, you know, I've listened to some talk radio when I'm driving around here, and I mean, people making some comments of a racial nature on there that I just can't even, like, fathom. And, like, so I think race issues are prominent in northern cities. I find it odd that, like, in southern cities like Atlanta, Charlotte, and Houston that have kind of done the better job of confronting their racism legacies. How do you heal those community divides? You talked about the one example, but how do you overcome that?
Well, I think we made huge progress on the civil rights constitutional side with the police community relations piece. Now the big frontier, which I'm devoting an enormous amount of effort and time to, is economic inclusion. I mean, I cited Atlanta over and over and over again in the campaign trail. If you look at Atlanta 40 years ago and today, I would argue, as I think you pointed out in some of your writings, that we have more inherent natural assets and bones than Atlanta does, although Atlanta, of course, being the capital of the South, maybe it's not a fair comparison. But the fact is we have better architecture, we have better companies, we have broader base, and we're more dense naturally than Atlanta is.
You know, Atlanta and Birmingham were about the same size in 1950. Atlanta was nothing.
Nothing.
Until they got their race, some of their race issues sorted out. It took a very forward-looking...
I couldn't agree with you more. And in fact, I've pointed this out a million times. So Atlanta, you know, which coined the phrase a city too busy to hate, never had a race riot. Think about that. Ebenezer, Martin Luther King's father's church in the heart of Atlanta, they never had a race riot. Of substantial size. I don't believe any. I can be contradicted by some small thing. But because Andrew Young, who was a keynote speaker at NAACP speech here in October, and he was really one of my heroes. He was the mayor of Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about this at great length. And he actually, I thought it was in the 50s, 60s, and 70s that this got going. But he said it really started in the 30s. The business community in Atlanta was so far more progressive in adopting and collaborating with the black community and saying we're never going to survive unless we have a win-win.
Mm-hmm.
So their efforts at building a broad, inclusive economy that built a black middle class, which is now the largest black middle class in the country, mm-hmm. home of all these great... Now, one major advantage they have is being the home of all these great historic black colleges,
mm-hmm.
several, which is a huge advantage we don't have. But they made a conscious effort to do that. And if you look at the population of Atlanta 40 years ago and today, it is quadrupled, right, or a huge, mm-hmm. huge increase. Their GDP far greater today than it was mm-hmm. 40 years ago. Black community is the largest middle class in the country, and white people are richer. So everybody is better off by adopting a progressive, inclusive mm-hmm. policy on race. And look at Cincinnati, as you've pointed mm-hmm. out, we have not grown at the rate of the national average. Our GDP is fine and doing great. We got a lot of natural assets, but it hasn't grown nearly at the rate mm-hmm. that Atlanta has grown. So what I've said throughout the campaign and since I've been in office is that it's not only the right thing to do from a historical baggage, and we have a history of issues and racism, like every mm-hmm. American does, that we need to confront and constantly deal with like we did mm-hmm. on sort of clear civil rights issues coming out. 2001 and 2002, But we also need to build an economy that works for everybody. There are a huge disparity of this wealth and health between black and white in Cincinnati and white and Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't tackle that, we're not going to grow it. And that's not just for African-American and Hispanics. That's for mm-hmm. white people, too. I mean, it's for
mm-hmm.
everybody.
Mm-hmm.
In Atlanta, everyone is better off mm-hmm. 40 years into their fairly aggressive, inclusive policies. So we have already launched a host of initiatives led by the biggest companies in town, Procter & Gamble, mm-hmm. Macy's, Kroger. They are supplier diversity. And sadly and ironically, they actually do a better job at supplier diversity than the city does.
Mm-hmm.
So P&G, Toyota, and Kroger's are all members of the Billion Dollar Roundtable, which means they essentially mm-hmm. spend $1 billion a year globally on African-American businesses. The city contracts about $300 to $400 million a year in a variety of services. And the last time they measured it, which was a year and a half ago, only 1.5% of the contracts were going to African-American businesses, 0% to a Latino, and only 6% to women. So we pledged to double the women-owned business contracts, to quadruple African-American to at least 15% by the end of next year, and to increase Hispanic contracts from 0% to 3% in the next couple of years, and then grow from there. And doing that by really changing the culture of procurement and aggressive outreach. And candidly, there's a way to do it that will save money, too, because a lot of what's happening, essentially, is contracts just get renewed mm-hmm. without a whole lot of thought to it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you this isn't a set-aside. This is about competition.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we enhance competition, we're going to save taxpayer money and build capacity among young African-American, Hispanic, and women entrepreneurs in Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we get an aggressive, we start, we're behind right now, but we're mm-hmm. going to really tackle this in a very aggressive manner and create and change the culture of inside City Hall, and then use that candidly in the leadership of the companies that have agreed to serve on this task force, want to first clean up this house and then continue the conversation regionally to really help market Cincinnati as a region, as a place where opportunity exists for everybody.
I think you hit on, we talked about raising some of the issues, you know, but Cincinnati, it has, I call this my Cincinnati conundrum. You get the best stuff,
mm-hmm.
but the city has kind of underperformed from a population and job growth, even versus regional peers like Columbus, Lexington, et cetera, over an extended period of time.
Right.
So since the city of Cincinnati went from 40% regional population share to 14, not dissimilar from everywhere, but I'm stunned that Hamilton County, Ohio, has lost 120,000 people since 1970.
Right.
Marion County, Indiana, and Indianapolis, which is about identical to same size, has gained 135,000.
Right.
The city of Cincinnati is down from well into the 500,000s, down to slightly below below 300,000. There's kind of been this trajectory of the core in a negative way, while places like Warren County have boomed. What have really been the factors that have driven some of the underperformance demographically here? And then kind of what do you think the inflection point, what's going to turn that up to a more aggressive growth profile?
Well, first of all, let me make a few mm-hmm. points. And then
mm-hmm.
first point is that the number one reason why our numbers have shrunk faster than other cities, and I'll get to the county issue mm-hmm. in a minute, is because we did not... Cincinnati has not annexed anything since 1925.
Right.
And Columbus was annexing as recently as 5 years ago. Okay. So now Columbus is virtually all of Franklin County, and you've got metro government down in Louisville now, I believe.
Louisville, Nashville, Indianapolis.
Indianapolis has got all that. So it's not fair to say, well, the city's 14% because these other cities have annexed aggressively.
Right. That's why I looked at the county populations.
Understood.
Yeah.
That's a different issue. But I think if you looked at the urban core, if you took... In essence, if you took our small geographic city, which is very small,
mm-hmm.
we stopped annexing in 1925, and you layered it, a similar urban core
mm-hmm.
to these other cities, Cleveland, for example, mm-hmm. Columbus, et cetera, we would crush any of those cities in terms of diversity, wealth, quality neighborhoods, safety. I mean, in Cleveland, there's not a single neighborhood as nice as Clifton. proper, let alone Hyde Park, Mount Lookout, Oakley, Mount Adams. I mean, we have incredible density still in our urban core, despite the fact that we lost population.
And I'll be honest, like household sizes have declined,
right.
So that's had an impact.
Well, that's had a huge impact. I mean, you look at now. I mean, you look at the big trends,
right
over 50 years, and then let me make the other point too. One is apples to apples. We didn't annex. Second point is this is changing, like literally under our feet. I mean, first of all, I don't buy that that our population is declining anymore. In fact, you know. In 2002 and 3, we challenged the consent. I forget what year it was that Mallory did it, but we challenged the census and we proved that they had undercounted a number of our people. I believe we are growing. I think building permits show that we're growing. Construction permits show that we're growing. Our downtown over the Rhine population is booming. We're now starting to see that it's so expensive. It's moved so quickly that young professionals are increasingly moving into adjacent neighborhoods outside of Over the Rhine because they can't afford Over the Rhine anymore. Mm-hmm. That's how fast the market is shifting. We're going to have thousands of new units built in downtown over the next couple of years. 3CDC is marching now north of Liberty Street towards Findlay Market.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see this incredible explosion. So first let me say that I really believe that you're going to see and are seeing that these trends are changing for the city proper.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, my, you know, history view is, you know, at 1860, whatever, Lincoln signed the Homestead Act and people moved out of cities to the west. Amazingly, even with the advent of the car, 1900, 1950, all cities got bigger and moved into the urban core. And then once Eisenhower built the highways, you had this mass exodus to the suburbs where the, wow, they weren't factoring in all the additional costs that would eventually have to be paid,
right.
Schools, infrastructure, sewers, water, all that stuff. It was very cheap for developers to take farmland and convert it to suburbs.
Like a total cost of ownership.
Right. So, you know, that was obviously a national trend. And then you have, you know, in Cincinnati, you have highly competitive Northern Kentucky, Butler, Warren, Claremont County, political jurisdictions that were actively marketing to bring people out of Hamilton County to those areas. And so it may be the case that Hamilton County hasn't fared as well as other counties, as you point out. But I believe that, and I'm consistent with some of the things you've read or you've written in the past, that we are more poised to recapture at least the city proper because of our bones, our culture, our sense of community, and I believe very pro-growth policies that we're adopting both in the city and the business community to really grow this economy. And I think we're already seeing that repopulation and we'll see it turbocharge over the next several years.
Looking at it regionally, you mentioned there's all these jurisdictions, three states, Hamilton County itself has got who knows how many municipalities in it. City of Cincinnati is 14% of the regional population. Do you see yourself, how does this region function as a region? And do you see yourself as really the mayor of Cincinnati, the city, or as more of a regional leader, or how does that work for you?
I think it's both. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that there's no question that virtually everyone in our region, even people that live in Northern Kentucky, think of themselves as living in Cincinnati, and that's good. I mean, it binds our region.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't have, you know, people who live in the suburbs don't say, I'm afraid to describe myself as living in Cincinnati. And I got to tell you, there's been a huge cultural shift consistent with my message that things are changing. When we got out of the race problems in 2001, I was on city council, when I would have meetings with business leaders, they would almost inevitably say, why should I stay in the city?
Mm-hmm.
Now, after all the things we've done to repopulate the urban core, to invest with 3CDC, to revitalize Over the Rhine, to build Washington Park, to really invest in our downtown urban population and create more restaurants and entertainment and amenities, and seeing this amazing renaissance that's happening right now, people, it's a huge sea change. Now business leaders say, how do I get more people downtown? I mean, there's a real cultural shift and renewed pride in Cincinnati. More specifically, though, there's some unique advantages that we have. You take the corporate tax base mm-hmm. of cities our size, well, of Midwestern peers.
Mm-hmm.
As I already mentioned, we already have probably better and deeper companies. This year, at some point, they already pinpointed the date, like in October. For the first time in our history, we're going to our GDP is going to surpass Cleveland,
mm-hmm.
be the largest economy in Ohio, okay? Even though we're much smaller population-wise. And Columbus has had a great run, there's no mm-hmm. question. And they get the benefit, frankly, of all the state money being capital. They've gotten a lot of extra money that, frankly, has come from our tax dollars
mm-hmm.
invested because of the seat of the capital. We're going to try and change that. But they've had a great run, and they got some great things happening. But Cincinnati, one of my goals is to think of it this way. You look at Columbus, if you took our downtown and uptown and the corporate base, remember we're getting 2.1% on earnings tax,
mm-hmm.
corporate profits, Procter & Gamble. You take that same geographic area of companies, let's say that's mm-hmm. 70% of all of our major jobs and income taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
You take the same exact area and map it in Columbus. They're going to have 70% of their companies nationwide, et cetera, all mm-hmm. within the same geographic area,
mm-hmm.
right? The difference is that they have to spread that money among all of Franklin County. We have to provide for 300,000 people in very quality 19th century historic neighborhoods that already have a sense of place and culture. And we get the benefit of, on a per capita basis, being able to invest way more in these urban neighborhoods than any of our peers because we didn't annex. Now, historically, the attitude of urbanists had been, like myself, that, we've got to have metro government, it'd be better, money is fleet, capital flight, white flight, all mm-hmm. these things, all these bad things have happened. In essence, the attitude has been, we poor city, we need, in essence, you guys to play Robin Hood for us,
mm-hmm.
okay? And they're fleeing purposefully to get away from the schools and the taxes and the crime and blight. I think the shift is already underway. Now, we have more work to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the shift is already underway that we're going to be a better choice for the dollar value because of our historic infrastructure, our density, our diverse economies of scale, the homeowner to apartment mix, which looks bad at a distance,
mm-hmm.
but candidly makes it more dense,
mm-hmm.
and which makes labor pools a lot easier to transport inside the city. That we have. What we haven't done, in my opinion, is be insistent enough on value for the dollar. Because we're spreading our dollar over a much smaller population than cities our size. So why isn't the quality of customer service of all services of city government as, superior?
Mm-hmm.
You still get complaints today, people who say, I live in a nice suburb, and my snow is picked up immediately, and it's cleaner, and my road mm-hmm. is paved faster, and less litter. Coming to the city, I can immediately tell it's a city. There's no excuse for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that we can provide better customer service because we have more money over less people than our competitors do. Which, if you think about the fact that, we lost population in cities this way, people kept moving one suburb out,
mm-hmm.
and I think most of us agree we're going to repopulate from the inside out.
Mm-hmm.
We have more resources to invest in economic growth policies than our competitors do, and we intend to use that advantage to become the most exciting urban city in the country.
Looking at that repopulation, mm-hmm. I do want to touch just briefly on the streetcar.
Sure.
Because I think that's a good issue to illustrate that there do seem to be in Cincinnati some just fundamental disagreements. We just don't agree on how the city should be doing things, or there's been a lot of tug of war on a lot of things here. Is this a divided community that makes it difficult to get things done, or is that just a single issue thing, or can you square that circle? How do you see kind of that thing where there seem to be some fundamental philosophical differences about an approach?
Oh, I think it's, I mean, I think the short answer is it's just one issue and really an investment strategy. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you are spending time in this city the next couple of years, mm-hmm. the next couple of days, you know, you're going to see an amazing renaissance and rebirth and over the mm-hmm. Rhine and downtown and riverfront. Mm-hmm. The streetcar is not going to be here for 3 years. Mm-hmm. The streetcar didn't produce that. Mm-hmm. What produced that is hundreds of millions of dollars invested by Macy's and P&G and Kroger and over $150 million invested by the city mm-hmm. in public-private partnership mm-hmm. to revitalize and rejuvenate our urban core. And if the streetcar advocates all said and say that it's not about transportation, it's about economic development. Just from my point of view, it's never been emotional. It's been what is the best value for the dollar. And if you take the $150 million that's being spent on the streetcar and we invested it with 3CDC and other public-private partnerships that have already proven to be hugely successful for us, in my opinion, it's a more efficient investment for the dollars.
So you don't think that this is, do you think it's just a one-off kind
absolutely.
Of thing? This
is not, I absolutely
it's not like you and the millennials are going to be butting heads.
I am a millennial. I mean, I am a young person. I am an urbanist. I, you know, I went into Price Hill, which is a much tougher neighborhood now than over the Rhine. Mm-hmm. And did a mixed-use, urban-friendly, pedestrian-friendly development. I was told by every bank that no one would invest, should invest in Price Hill. And unlike mm-hmm. the revitalizations and over the Rhine, I didn't have Macy's and P&G mm-hmm. and others. This is when I went into the private sector. Mm-hmm. Behind me, writing huge checks. I wasn't in walking distance of downtown. We were in a West Side neighborhood that suffered severe stress mm-hmm. and decline over 40 years, but it has amazing views, amazing infrastructure, amazing architecture, amazing park spaces. And we did a new restaurant and some condos, and now a new community live theater is being built on the spot. And bankers told me they were doing me a favor by not lending to me. Mm-hmm. Restaurateurs said it'd be a miracle if the restaurant grows $600,000 a year. Last year we have a percent rent. Last year they grossed $1.8 million in 2,500 square feet of inside space, and they got about 1,000 outside square feet. Insane, untapped demand for re-urbanism. And that is now increasingly a young professional because they can't afford over the Rhine. Mm-hmm. As I like to say, we tell ourselves we're revitalizing over the Rhine and the, downtown for young professionals, but increasingly it's divorcees you know, that are building up the price. And now we're seeing Northside, Clifton, Walnut Hills, East Price Hill, which are close to downtown but not as close as over the Rhine, starting to repopulate. So I've never understood the emotion on the other side of the streetcar. It's an investment strategy. What's the most efficient use of those dollars to get what we want, which is the most exciting urban city in America? Mm-hmm. If every city's doing a streetcar, then that doesn't set us apart. And frankly, the success we've already seen is proof is already in the pudding. Mm-hmm. And this is a huge risk, you know, that the streetcar will work. You know, I'm about to announce a major expansion of bike share in downtown over the downtown from downtown to uptown, mm-hmm. which is, you know, very popular along the same lines, but a fraction of the cost. You know, $1 million one time spent versus $150 million mm-hmm. and never ending ongoing operating expenses. Mm-hmm. So, from my point of view, it's always been just a question of what's the best use of the dollar.
So, what's with this where do you go to high school thing in Cincinnati?
You know, I think that it's there. I mean, you know, there's a lot of pride in good pride. And sometimes, you know, we got to make sure that it's not off putting to people who aren't from here. But to the point we made earlier about sense of neighborhood and culture, there's good and bad to everything that you got, you know.
So where did you go to high school, and what would that mean to someone who was from Cincinnati?
Well, I went to St. X High School, which is a Jesuit mm-hmm. Catholic high school. You know, the parochial schools, the Elder Moeller Seton schools, are historically were neighborhood-based, and St. X is more of a magnet school, so that has a lot of connotations with it. Draws from east and west, brings people together.
Louisville, St. X, and Louisville sort of an elite, St. X and Trinity are the two elite Catholic guys. So is that sort of the same thing here a little bit?
Yeah. People would say that, yes.
Yeah. Well, sort of like, that's what I say, when people ask you, you know that they're looking to like, where's the cultural, it puts you in a cultural box to know where you went to high, you know, where you went to high school.
There's good and bad baggage to all of this.
You know, one thing I didn't highlight in your bio at the beginning that I saw that intrigued me is you have a master's of theology
right.
from Harvard Divinity School.
Right.
You say that faith, you're a man of deep faith, that's important to you. How does that inform, you know, the approach you bring to your job as mayor?
Well, I think that all of this has to be done in the context of the common good and building a society that expands opportunity. And I think at the end of our lives, we're fundamentally going to be asked, did we make the world a better place for those who didn't have as many advantages as we had? Do we leave it better than we found it? Sense of stewardship. And all of that comes, I think, deeply from my faith, and schooling, and family values, traditions, etc. And so, you know, we spent an enormous amount of time thinking about how we're going to reduce the poverty rate. One of my major planks in my campaign was reducing the poverty rate by at least 5% over the next 4 years. And we are engaged at every level, re-examining the dollars that are federal dollars that come into the city budget that are earmarked for low-income individuals and must be spent to the benefit of low-income individuals. Mm-hmm. Are we really getting the most bang for the buck out of those dollars? We have some additional dollars that we free up out of our budget for the benefit of human services and investment mm-hmm. of that nature. We're spending an enormous amount of time on that. We are searching for any and every pot of money that exists out there that could help us combat long-term unemployment, poverty. I've been to D.C. a few times to talk and work with their long-term unemployment plan. I convinced Procter & Gamble and some other major companies to adopt some of the Obama policies on hiring practices to reduce the real mental health tragedies associated with long-term unemployment. I think that, you know, we have different demographics, as you point out in a lot of your writing, between, you know, Portland, which might have an average graduation rate, a college graduation rate of 50%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cincinnati's probably 20%, right? 25% city proper, okay? So the question is how do we turn that into an advantage?
Mm-hmm.
And if we invest, in my opinion, in good job training, workforce readiness programs, so that we have, right now we have a cohort coming out of the Great Recession of folks who have never had a high school or college degree with kids who have got very bleak prospects. And that is, you know, not surprisingly, where those folks live tend to be mm-hmm. some of our toughest neighborhoods. If we can, I think, rise to the moral challenge of figuring out how to not write off this entire generation, but invest in job training and skill set to get them at least ready to work at low-skill, mm-hmm. low-paying jobs, and bring the dignity back of having a breadwinner in the family, the social dividends of that are enormous in terms of turning those neighborhoods around, those families around, the city around. But in addition, if we can do it on a systematic basis, we can then market Cincinnati as a place for companies who want to locate with a large, ready-to-work population. Whereas in Portland, where you have higher education turnouts, it's hard to get people to take lower-skilled jobs,
mm-hmm.
right? Real pricing out. Here we have an opportunity to take what looks at, by some studies to be a disadvantage, low education rate compared to Portland, and turn it into an advantage, and give ourselves a real marketing edge to bring companies here. Now,
more diverse workforce education.
More diverse workforce. Yeah. Now, obviously, 20, 30 years from now, I'd love for us to have a higher education rate, and I'm also invested in trying to figure out how to pay for expanded preschool like de Blasio has in New York. We have a preschool promise where we're trying to invest in 3- and 4-year-olds into preschool education. And I'm not saying it's good and we just want to leave the education rates where they are. But given what we have today, how do we turn all that into an advantage and at the same time tackle the moral issues of poverty? And while it's not the same thing, and a very sensitive issue, this is not the same thing, but building a more inclusive and welcoming society for immigrants and for African Americans and Hispanics is also, I think, part of my faith tradition of you know, it does come from a history
mm-hmm.
of prejudice Cincinnati has been part of. And so we do have a moral obligation to tackle those issues, but I do think from a political standpoint, it's better and true, mm-hmm. not just better political argument, which it is, but it's also true, then it's better for all of us to have a more inclusive and welcoming city. So I've also launched a number of pro-immigration strategies in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, Cincinnati's immigration rates have been very low historically.
Correct.
Is this some of the same motivation that underlaid your work with the Ohio Innocence Project?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, I became a lawyer because I read To Kill a Mockingbird as a kid and said, you know, this is what I want to do. And, you know, I mean, if you think about the story of To Kill a Mockingbird, it's identical to what the Innocence Project does on a daily basis. And so when I was young and didn't have a family and I was on city council, I was at a big law firm and I thought, hey, I can probably do something else besides council, which was part-time. So it's a long story, but the short version is that I had seen these Innocence Projects pop up in other states and I saw that there was none in Ohio and it would be great for UC, it'd be great. And of course, we've gotten 16 people out of prison now in the last 10 years. Of course, I haven't been formally involved in 7 years, but the co-founder and I are practically best friends, and he still runs it. We're very close, and my wife's on the board, and I help raise money for him, and it's an amazing success story. But there's no question that it gets back to the tradition of wanting to see the world better and to deal with injustices and build a more, you know, just society.
Last question. You know, I'm speaking at the University of Cincinnati tonight. I know the crowd there is going to want to know the answer to one question, and that is, what's your position on the Central Parkway protected bike lane?
That's funny. Well, first of all, under my leadership, well, I shouldn't say my leadership, under our public-private relationships and support of council and a very vibrant cyclist community, in my opinion, we're going to be the most bike-friendly city in America in 4 years. We have literally a bicycle trail that goes from Lunkin Airport, which is a small municipal airport on the east side, with a few gaps, connects to the Loveland Trail, which is one of the best dedicated bike trails in the region, in the suburban area, but it goes north all the way up to Cleveland, essentially. Hugely used, great amenity for our region. It's missing that link to the urban core. One of the cities I reference often is Denver, and my wife and I personally rode on its dedicated bike trail in the, have you been there? In the
I've been to Denver, but I'm not, you know, not since they put that in.
It's incredible. And you can literally ride a bike on a dedicated line, not in the street, in a dedicated line, jam runners and bikers all the way into downtown. It's somehow they got lucky with kind of a, I don't know what it is, but it's like a gutter, essentially, that's been cleaned up. And there are streams and parts of it. And they have this bike trail that goes all the way into downtown Denver. But we have three major bike trails that can be connected on abandoned train tracks from into downtown. And candidly, we intend to get all three of them built in the next 4 years. And there's just nothing like it in any city. I mean, Denver has one great line that goes into the urban core. We're going to have three, from one from the west side, one from the more northern part, and one that goes directly on the eastern riverside all the way to Lunkin and then connects the Riverfront Trail. And the best part is that when we connect these other three bike trails into downtown, we're then going to have the connection to get into the Loveland bike trail. So essentially, any bike trail that we're going to have, and these three major lines will connect to the trail all the way up to Cleveland. Essentially, with maybe two or three exceptions, never have to cross the street, get off the bike, and ride with cars. In addition to that, we are launching, as I mentioned already, a huge, which is frankly the number one issue for the bike enthusiasts right now, is bike share. Are you familiar with bike share at all?
I know what bike share is, yeah.
So we're about to, which I do take a great deal of enjoyment in, is that the streetcar folks have said we got to connect downtown uptown, which they won't even do the downtown piece for three more years. This summer, I'll have bicycles running from Clifton to downtown for a fraction of the cost in a public-private partnership, connecting those two job employment bases. It won't take us 10 years. It'll take us about 3 months. And so we're going to have, and that is the number one priority for the bicycle community. To your question, we are, the question is simply whether the current configuration of that bike trail is the most effective. And we've gotten complaints from businesses that are being displaced. There's a guy who has, Parkinson's. The guy has a business there who invested millions of dollars, and he has one of his tenants is a Parkinson's community, and they have daily activities for the members of this group, and they park between 7 and 9 a.m., and the current configuration is to eliminate on-street parking from 7 to 9 a.m. There's got to be a way around that problem. There's got to be a win-win solution, and frankly, from a pro-pedestrian, urban-friendly point of view, you always want to save on-street parking. You know, on-street parking slows down traffic because when you're driving, you're worried you're going to hit the car's windshield or, you know, mirrors. And what I want to see is pedestrian-friendly, urban-friendly neighborhoods and city. And so I'm very loath to see on-street parking be taken away. Now, they're talking about taking away just during rush hour, but it has this hugely negative impact on this these businesses, including a more sympathetic case of this Parkinson's group, which then really have a very hard time getting to where they're trying to go. So we're just trying to drill down into the oversight of it. In our view, the previous administration was often very sloppy and sort of, I would say, academically callous in how they read or imported passively. Progressive cities do bike lanes, so we'll do bike lanes. And damn the torpedoes, we won't think about doing it in a way that's consistent with existing business investment, preserving on-street parking, things of that nature. So what we're trying to do is bring oversight to make sure that all these things done are done efficiently and with common sense.